Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 560th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta.
So in our last podcast, we talked about ketamine and its role for depression, because there's a big interest in some of these, for lack of a better word, I don't know if you call them psychedelic drugs. I guess you would.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, that's often the term used. Yeah. Or hallucinogens.
Hallucinogens. And so we're going to talk about a different agent today. And you and I, just before we started the podcast, had a discussion about how you even say it. And I think I was wrong. So why don't you tell them how to pronounce it?
Yeah, so we're going to talk about psilocybin, which is derived, that's the medical ingredient, if you will, or the hallucinogen ingredient in magic mushrooms. And just as a reminder, so where did we leave off? And James, you said we talked about ketamine. I would say many of our listeners might say we rambled.
Well,
about ketamine.
I leave it up to the listener to decide.
Okay, so, and just as a reminder, S-ketamine, which had the better evidence because it's still under patent, it had, it showed about a 10% improvement in remission for hard-to-treat depression and a MADRS score of that's just kind of bordering on something clinically meaningful. Ketamine, on the other hand, had more biases, looked better, for remission, but had more biases. And really, and then we talked at the very end about the fact that there is a clinical trial that there is evidence that raises suspicion about the whole thing. But if you were a guessing person and you had to guess from the available evidence, you'd say maybe 10%.
Yes, which is similar to pretty much every other drug. Now, it may be in a different context of the severity of the depression or the resistance of it.
Right, exactly. Probably a little harder to treat, and so maybe a little better, but we weren't seeing no real clinical trials that showed better than a 50% improvement in the treatment group, and in some cases down to only 35, 30 kind of thing. So just a reminder that it's not curing everyone. But let's go on to psilocybin, and we'll talk about it. Now, there are lots of systematic reviews of this, but it turns out that most of them aren't very useful. So 13 systematic reviews I could find of randomized controlled trials, but they had lots of limits. So the first five had combined, in their meta-analysis, they combined other agents in with psilocybin. So things like LSD and other hallucinogens. Or in two of them, they actually included healthy people, which of course we discussed earlier. It's hard to tell if you're making a difference in depression when the people don't have depression.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a point one on.
Yeah, that might be the key. And then there are five narrative ones. And we've talked about this a lot. When you have a narrative systematic review, you do all of the stuff that's important about how you select the studies and all of that. But then you can kind of randomly select the outcomes that you want to present. And it just creates a high risk of bias for selective reporting. So I generally ignore those guys. And then there was one that was of depression, but actually missed a lot of the key studies because by the time it completed its study selection, a whole bunch of bigger studies came out. Not a whole bunch, but a few that are key. One looked at dose and found that probably 25 milligrams is better than 10, which is borne out by the largest clinical trial. And the last one, which is interesting, isn't useful for efficacy, but it looked at methodological issues. And two important biases were identified. There were seven psilocybin RCTs that they found. Six of them reported whether the participants had used psychedelics or hallucinogens in the past. Out of those six, it was 6% in one, so very few, but the rest were quite high, 45, 55, 67, 92, and 100%. And this is very similar to what we saw with cannabinoids.
Yeah, yeah. So, and it's important, right? Because it makes it tricky because that creates its own bias.
Right. So one of the key ones for everyone to remember is if I've been using something in the past and I'm willing to go into a clinical trial of that thing, that means that I'm willing to accept the experiences that I've had, or they're not as serious for me. And what I mean by that is the adverse events. Mm-hmm. So if I tried something like magic mushrooms in my past and I was, sick all night long vomiting, I'm not likely to allow myself to enroll in a clinical trial.
No, exactly.
So it biases towards minimizing adverse events. And that's, again, what we saw with cannabinoids. The other piece that I think is important is the reporting of blinding. So 4 actually reported blinding. 2 just said straight up it wasn't successful. And the other 2 reported that anywhere from 93 to 97% of the patients and the study personnel could correctly identify who had been given psilocybin and who had not.
So, and for those of you who are following along, 93 and 97 is very close to 100.
Yeah, so you might take from this that these are not blinded trials. Yeah. I appreciate the fact that they tried to do blinded trials, but it is very tricky with these, and that leads to expectation bias, etc., which we talked a lot about last time.
And it's not a criticism of the researchers at all. This is very, very difficult to blind.
Yeah, you can't. It's like...
Almost impossible.
Yeah, you can, and there's certain things. You're not going to blind an operation where the other arm gets no operation. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't meant to imply it was a limb surgery.
Nope.
There's a slip there. So it's a...
But you can do sham surgery, so that's...
You can do sham surgery, but you can't... If there's something like an amputation or that, people will notice.
Is that right?
Yeah, they will notice. Is true of other things. Like, let's say you were going to do hyperbaric treatment. You can try and sham that by putting people into chambers and slightly changing pressure. But again, most people can tell who got it. So, and then true of drugs that have adverse events that are quite significant, right? That people can tell.
Right.
Then as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the premise of what we're going in with. So now let's jump to the 4 clinical trials that looked at patients who were suffering from depression not related to another condition. So we'll talk very briefly at the end about trials and studies where they examine depression and anxiety in people suffering from life-threatening illnesses. But for now, these are major depression episodes without that kind of link. And we'll start 2021. A study was published in JAMA Psychiatry that had they tried to enroll 27, but really they got 24 to actually stay in the study. This was an interesting design. So these guys kind of said, yeah, you can't blind. So what we're going to do instead is just put people on a wait list. And we're going to acknowledge that you can tell, but we're not going to try and fake a placebo arm. We're going to use a wait list arm. So that's just, it's an interesting kind of, you might say throwing the towel in, but I think it's not unreasonable.
No.
These are classic studies of this kind of people. They're age 40. They've had depression on average for 22 years on and off. Mm-hmm. The average person had used a 0.8 psychedelic use in the past. So that means that just under an average of just under 1. So it's a lot probably at 0 and a few at 1 or more. And this arm, what they did in this study is... They took you and they gave you they gave you 2 doses, and it ended up being 1.6 weeks apart. I don't know why that number was chosen. Go ahead, James.
No, just go back and look at previous weeks. 1.5 weeks didn't work.
Yeah. And 2 was too much.
Yeah, it's like dosing of antibiotics. 10 days is fine, but 9 days is stupid.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So... the treatment was 20 milligrams for 70 kilograms. So that is what they called a low to moderate dose. And then the next dose was a higher dose at 30 milligrams per 70 kilograms. That is pretty much what's used universally. It's generally around 25 or something like that. So they were right in the middle. And then wait list. Now, what happened was if you were on the wait list for your obligatory 8 weeks, you were then switched and you got treatment. So it makes some of this reporting super tricky. And it was the classic kind of psilocybin. So there were multiple meetings up front, 8 hours of preparatory meetings, where you're getting counseling and preparation for the treatment. Then the treatment itself was 11 hours. I've seen them as low as kind of around 8, but the treatment is often, it's a full day thing. And then a 2 to 3 hour follow-up meeting with the counselors. And there's always 2 counselors per patient. That's in case anyone has to step out. Common way this is done is you're given headphones, playing kind of soft music. You're given eye shades and you receive the medicine. And then if you're having distress, which a lot of people do, we'll talk about that later, you get kind of counseling that takes you through that. And again, there's always 2 people present.
Yeah. So this is not a very simple procedure. And this is something that requires fairly intensive, sort of care right around that time, which is very different than many of the other medications that we might use for depression. Although, as here is an oldie but a goodie, I remember when the ACE inhibitors first came on the market, Captopril, we hospitalized patients whenever we gave them the first dose because we gave them big doses.
I would do the same still today, James, if I had my way.
Well, I know.
Every blood pressure medicine.
Yes, I know, exactly. And prior to every dose.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, I can understand they were maybe anxious about hypotension. Was that it or what?
Oh no, exactly. No, they couldn't understand why giving like 150 to 300 milligrams of Captopril lowered blood pressure in a few people a lot.
So you advocated for 450 instead.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you might as well make them collapse.
Yeah, and shock the heck out of the kidneys.
Yeah, but anyway, so you need to be careful with this treatment.
And it's not, it's very intensive treatment. It's not something that just is decided on whimsically, that's for sure. Okay, so let's talk about what these guys found. Well, they used a kind of different scoring system called the GRID HAM-D. It's an established one, but it is a bit different. And it goes from 0 to 52. If you're less than 7 or less, you're not depressed. At greater than 24, you're considered severe depression. These guys started right around 23, so right at that cusp. And if you were given the immediate treatment of psilocybin, you went from 23, and at week 5, your score was 8, and at 8 weeks, it was 8.5. So obviously a big reduction, and that's compared to waitlist, which went from 23 up to 24, and that was at both week 5 and 8. So one is going down to 8, and the other one is staying stable at around 24. So obviously it looks good. Now, I tried to get the remission and response statistics, but they only gave them for the treatment people.
Right.
Because everyone ended up getting treatment. So we don't have a comparator group. It's basically 71% get a response, which is at least a 50% improvement in your score, or around just over 50% get remission, which is less than 7.
But I mean, if the wait list, if the actual GRID HAM-D score didn't change much at all, you wouldn't expect that many had gotten a...
No, you wouldn't expect to change. But it's unfortunate. The way they present these stats is a little bit unusual to me anyway.
Yeah.
But still, you know, it seems to be effective. I also found it strange that they reported remission and response at different time points than they reported their score changes. So I almost got a sense of selective reporting, but
yeah,
I won't...
That, yeah.
I won't go there because I don't know, but I'm just, it's a bit of a concern.
Well, but Mike, you just said it. So you really did go there.
I did go there. Yeah.
You didn't go to cover. Yeah. Yeah. So there was absolutely no selective reporting. And no, just kidding.
Yeah. I'm saying there was absolutely none, except there probably was.
Yeah, exactly.
Now I don't actually
we don't know,
but it just always makes us scratch our head. Why would you give different time points, but let's move on from there. to the next trial, which was published in New England Journal. And this one was 59 patients, so just over double. But what's funny I find in this one is that there were over 50 outcomes, which is probably similar to the one with 24. So it's about the same number of outcomes studied as the number of patients, just yeah. to keep that in mind. Yeah.
And it's I mean, I you do want to measure a lot of things.
Absolutely, I get it.
But you got to stop at some point.
And you have to recognize that there's high risk when you're doing that. And this one, what did they do? Well, they gave psilocybin 25 milligram doses times two once every 3 weeks. So once when you first came in, another one at 3 weeks later, and then followed you up to 6 weeks. And they compared that to escitalopram, which you got 10 milligrams for 3 weeks, and then you were bumped up to 20 milligrams for the last 3 weeks. So the KID score is another depression score. This one's from 0 to 27. Their baseline was 15, which is considered, again, as you'd expect, bad. And then they saw how much it reduced. So psilocybin reduced the score by 8 versus escitalopram, which reduced it by 6. So that wasn't statistically different. And remember, in the first one where we saw these big differences, that's because they were weightless, which is even worse than a placebo.
Yeah.
Because people get frustrated by a wait list. In this case, they're given escitalopram, which has an effect.
Yeah. But again, still they know what they're getting.
Yeah, they absolutely know they're getting, for sure. And then the KID score remission criteria, so that would be basically similar to what we've already seen. That was psilocybin 57% versus escitalopram 28%. Number needed to treat of around 4. And before you get too excited about that, recognize that that's the only one that reached statistical significance. So the Madras who got to remission in a Madras score wasn't, who got response in the KID score, that wasn't statistically significant. So what this was a signal that it seems to work at least as good as escitalopram or maybe better.
Yeah. And it's tricky, right? To see if you see no difference in the average change. I mean, there was two between them, but there was a statistical difference. To then see, you know, what are we talking about? A 25% absolute difference in the number of people who got to a certain remission. That's quite something.
Yeah, it suggests a fluke, right? Because the other ones weren't.
Yeah.
Now, they should be, because the score was a little bit better, there should be a more of them reaching remission.
Oh, yeah, for sure, yeah.
But reaching that level of difference, 25 points, that, and as I said, that's why, you know, don't get too excited, because there were other response and remission criteria that weren't statistically different. So it's just signals that, like I said, if you were to sum it up, it's as good as escitalopram or likely better. Or possibly.
Yeah, but yeah, I think get rid of the word likely. I think, you know, and we would say that even if this was a perfect trial and it was just one trial, we'd still say, you know, it could be, but we need more anyway. But there are more studies though.
Right. There's two others and they're both bigger now. So we've gone from 24 to 59 and now we're going to go to the biggest one, which is 233. It's bigger because it has three arms in it. Again, very similar patients, long history of depression. I've tried multiple antidepressants. And in this, they're randomized to 25 milligrams of psilocybin, 10 milligrams, or 1 milligram. Now, that 1 milligram is effectively the control dose, and it was hoped that you would get some kind of effect that might help blind you. So you'll see that in the next couple. They're trying to simulate some kind of blinding. Now, it didn't work, it turns out, but still, you give them credit. As you said right at the beginning, this is super hard to blind for this kind of thing. Okay, so at 3 weeks, the Madras score, which goes from 0 to 60, and they started out at 32, which is bad. That's a bad depression, severe. Mm-hmm. And they found that 25 milligrams reduced the score by 12 points, and the 1 milligram reduced the score by 5 points. So in other words, they're getting better. They're going down. In the severity, but and the key thing here is, we talk about this a lot, the minimal clinically important difference is 3 to 6, and in this study it was 7 points better. So this is something that's clinically meaningful, the average improvement. And then the next question is, well, how many got either remission or a response? Well, remission on the MADRS scale was 29% for psilocybin at 3 weeks versus 8% for 1 milligram. That's a number needed to treat around 5. So, you know, pretty good. Again, you know, 29% are getting remission. It's not 100%. It's not even 50%, but it's still
it's something
better than the control group, the 1 milligram. And last thing we'll say is that the 10 milligram was not statistically different from the 1 milligram.
But was the 25 statistically better than the 10?
Interestingly, they weren't tested 25 to 10, only 10 to 1 and 25 to 1.
And it would be nice to know because, you know, you can have, you know, 25 being better than 1. You could also have 10 not being better than 1, but you could also have 10 not being better than 25. So then 10 might be the right dose. It's tricky.
It is tricky. But if you were looking at the curves, it wasn't tested, but it looks like the 10 isn't much different from the 1.
Okay,
Who knows? That's eyeballing it.
Yeah.
But so, and then there was no difference at 12 weeks. So interestingly, they tested at 3 and 12. This is one of the questions. This is a single dose study. And so this is one of the big questions we talked about with ketamine.
Yeah.
Is how long does the effect last? So this is giving us the signal that it lasts 3 weeks, but we don't know if it doesn't last 12. We just don't know in between.
Yeah. I mean, because that's going to be the big question is how often you have to do this, because it's not as simple as just taking a pill every day.
No, it's a massive expense, and you know, it's mainly just the big resource intense, and that leads to expense.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about the last one, which is 104 patients, and this one was very kind of interesting. And I ended up scouring some and looking at some of the other old trials, and it's not the only time this is done, but it's instead of comparing to placebo or to a low dose. In this study, they gave patients, so they gave them 25 milligrams of psilocybin or 100 milligrams of niacin, which I actually thought was quite creative for trying to make you feel like something's happening.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if they're exactly, having never taken either. I don't know, but
you could still tell. Like this is.
Yeah, yeah. I'd have thought.
You know, you're trying. They're trying.
Yeah.
And these were patients not quite as they're severe depression, but they're not. They haven't had the duration and all of the attempts.
Right.
And these guys couldn't. They were really enforced that you can't be on medicines. And so, what did they find? Well, at 8 days, with a baseline MADRS of 35, again, that's quite high.
Mm-hmm.
Psilocybin reduced your score or reduced the score by 18 points, which is pretty big, and niacin by 6 points. So, and that the results were similar at 6 weeks. So this is now telling us that the effects last 6 weeks, but not 12 weeks.
Right, right.
So helpful from that perspective as well. And who got remission? That was 35% in psilocybin and 8% in niacin, number needed to treat 4. Again, this is an important thing because it's telling us again that this is not the cure-all. It's about a third of patients who are getting remission.
Yeah. But definitely it suggests some sort of an effect. We're not sure about the duration. But the nice thing is it doesn't cause any side effects.
Yeah. There's no. So let's get into side effects because they certainly do exist with these kind of agents. So the first trial, the 24-person trial, that one presented. What they did is they presented scores on a bunch of different potential outcomes. So it's a bit more complicated, but they also presented something that the other trials didn't, which is they really broke it down into these kind of emotional responses. And they said what percentage of, and what they did is because these patients got two doses, each patient counts twice.
Mm.
So it's a little bit tricky to interpret, but as a percent, the number of times a patient is, so remember each patient is counted twice. So, if you looked at the summary of patient experiences, 92% of the time they'll have they'll say yes to, I felt like crying during treatment, or 79% will report, I felt sadness or emotional or physical suffering, 55, their body shaking 67, sorry, that emotional and physical suffering was 77%. Mm-hmm. And then getting a mystical experience on the first dose, which was lower in that study, it was 38%. And on the second dose, it was 54%.
Well, that sounds like my Tuesday.
There were a lot more of them there. I'm laughing at the mystical experiences. If your Tuesday feels like crying.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
It might be time for you to get some of these treatments, yeah. James. But let's talk about some of the other endpoints, because there are some of the other adverse events, because a lot of the clinical trials collected adverse event data that I think is helpful for us. So the first one is this clinical trial where they looked at escitalopram. And mm-hmm. what they found was that it was similar in the number of any adverse events, so kind of 87 to 83%. And then if you looked at things like headache, psilocybin had more of that, 67% versus 52%. Not statistically tested, mm-hmm. just more. But if you looked at things like fatigue, actually escitalopram had more of that, 24% versus 7%.
Yeah, and because, you know, it's important to because SSRIs do have a decent number of side effects, especially early on.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is a 3-week and then 6-week mm-hmm. trial. So like 3 weeks for the first dose and 3 more weeks, so a total mm-hmm. of 6 weeks. 3 weeks for the first dose and then 3 more weeks for the increased dose mm-hmm. of escitalopram. So it's measured at 6 weeks. So you had a chance at a pretty good dose of escitalopram, 20 milligrams. Mm-hmm. Then let's talk about some of the other adverse events. So the trial that had three arms of 25, 10, and 1 milligram, any adverse event went up exactly as you'd expect. So 1 milligram, it was 38%, but at 25 milligrams, it was 61% had an adverse event. Headache went up with it. Nausea went up with it. So these are the kind of things that are what we see a fair amount, but less of the dizziness and things like that we saw with ketamine, which is interesting. Right.
And it's tricky because I would imagine they just report the side effects. They don't, because if these are, you know, sort of a single dose events, they're not talking about, are they talking about at the time of the administration or are they talking weeks later? I bet it's not that clear.
No, some of them actually tease that out, James, which mm-hmm. is good of them. Mm-hmm. But some of it continues on for a little while. Like, for example, in the 25 milligram ones, after their dose on day two up to 3 weeks later, mm-hmm. they were still reporting adverse events. Now, it got much closer, 56% versus 44%.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And then most of it had washed away. So the psilocybin is almost, not entirely, but a lot up front is right. the adverse events. Yeah. And then they dwindle down. And the same is true of some of the others. It's things like for psilocybin versus niacin, it's for headache, it's 66% versus 24%. Nausea is 48 versus 6. Yeah. So visual perceptions on dosing day is 44 versus 6. So they are causing adverse events, but maybe not quite to the degree that we were seeing with the ketamine, which
yeah,
is
for sure. Yeah, yeah.
So, but S-ketamine is the best studied, and it was being given day after day, not day after day, but multiple times in a week, right?
Yeah, so exactly.
Likely to see more. So that summarizes all of the available data. You would say, if you were a guessing person, that psilocybin works. Mm-hmm. And why is it a guessing person? Because of that whole expectation bias. Like, there is data showing it works. It's relatively positive. It's very labor intensive, like resource intensive. But I think we would say that it probably works or almost certainly works, but there is a high risk of bias there with expectation bias, particularly.
And I'm letting you, letting you use the word works because we've already gone over the exact numbers.
Yeah,
it, exactly. So it's because it's and I don't not getting on your case, but it's not unusual to hear people say, "Oh yeah, it works."
Yeah, but we've gone over in painful detail.
Right? Yeah, yeah, because work could mean if you studied 10,000 people, it had a 1% effect.
Oh, for sure. We've seen that lots. In fact, we were talking about escitalopram. People talk about escitalopram being better than citalopram. It's not. It's in fractions of a difference in a point of a madrasca.
Exactly.
It's not meaningful by any stretch. Well, let's talk about the last thing. So the cost is, it's very hard to get an estimate of the cost because of all of the things that counseling and that. There is a cost effectiveness study, which because it assumes that the psilocybin is so much better than SSRIs, piles a lot of things onto the SSRIs, like the risk of self-harm, the days lost of work for not being able to, because you're not getting as good a response, et cetera. So the cost effectiveness is, they say for psilocybin, the cost is $10,000 to $13,000 versus SSRIs, which are just under $6,000. That doesn't count. If you look at the drug cost of psilocybin, I did find these. The drug cost of psilocybin is around $6,000 to $9,000, and the SSRI is around $37.
Right, yeah. So there's a big difference there. And you usually don't have to stay with the person for 11 hours after taking an SSRI.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's a lot of, and you know as well as I do, James, the cost effectiveness analysis are often done by the industry, and they tend to analyze the data in a way that's most positive for their drug.
Yeah, cost effectiveness analyses are always, I think there's some use to them, but boy, are they, you can make them almost say anything.
Well, I remember one was between, couple thousand to $2 million, depending on how you analyze the data. That was one of them I saw years and years ago. And I was like, That's a difference.
You said, well done. Well, that's good that you had a grasp of the completely freaking obvious.
So, and then the last thing is, how does it work with how it's often kind of how it started, which was with life-threatening illness? And you'll see some of the media articles portray this. It's use in people with, obviously desperately down because they've been informed of a terminal illness that they have.
Right.
And so there are studies in that, and it does help in those cases. So there is some hope relieving anxiety and depression related to those conditions. I didn't dive into them. Most of them report standard mean differences. They're difficult to interpret.
Yeah, exactly. But great job. I mean, we've now gone over sort of the ketamines and the esketamine and is that right? Did I say it right? Esketamine? The psilocybin. And when you were in practice, what would you do with this now?
Well, for the most part, this isn't for family docs.
No.
But it is part of advocacy for patients and discussing with them. So I would tell them that the effects are grossly exaggerated in the media. We know that. We know that to be true. And that it won't work for at least half and maybe two-thirds of patients.
Right.
For ketamine. And it might be a little bit better for psilocybin, but it's not a ton better.
Yeah. And no head-to-head trials.
Yeah, and no head-to-head trials between them yet. Head-to-head trials versus other things like niacin. But versus escitalopram, and it did look like it was eking out a little ahead, but not statistically different, and way too small a study for that kind of thing. It's more of a proof of concept that it's at least as good as. So I would reassure patients that, and all the guidelines recommend the same thing. For ketamine, they're a little bit more lenient, but for psilocybin, they're saying it's and understand that most of the evidence for psilocybin, well, all of it basically for depression is between 2021 and 2023, most of the guideline panels would be meeting in the last about 2 years ahead of that.
Right.
So in their defense, the evidence has moved faster than they can really work on guidelines. But right now, the arguments for psilocybin and in both the veterans guideline and the Canadian ones is that it should not be used outside of kind of experimental scenarios. So
Or not necessarily experiment, but being in under the guise of a study.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's you know, so much is experimental, but you mean almost under the guise
I guess if I'm trying it myself.
It's an experiment.
You could actually buy some of these that could be considered experimental. Right. It's in a study setting is what they're advocating for it. So their exact terms is, apart from ketamine, psychedelics shouldn't be prescribed outside of Health Canada approved clinical trials or special access programs.
For sure.
And that special access program would particularly be true of ones where they're patients suffering from a terminal illness, that kind of thing. So
So definitely, some effect. We've talked about the numbers. Very relatively expensive. Lots, and I'm not embarrassed to say lots of side effects. Now, hopefully, we don't know how long they go on for, and all that sort of stuff. And we don't know how often you repeat the dosing. Boy, it's tricky.
Yeah, there's still a lot. There's still a lot to be learned, but it is a. It's interesting. This area has. You know, it reminds me of the cannabinoid thing about the enthusiasm in the media and the general public far exceeds the evidence. But at least I will give the manufacturers of psilocybin credit. They're actually doing clinical trials where the cannabis guys were just trying to get it approved, or where doctors and healthcare providers could authorize it before they had really good evidence.
But great job on all this evidence. This is you know, this requires a pretty good ability to look at studies to be able to tease this information out. This is not easy stuff, and like we just said, you can't just say that it works
you have to describe how it works before you. The summative it works is because we've gone through four different RCTs in this case and way more ketamine studies. So
excellent job on that. Anything else you want to add?
Nope, that is good, James.
Excellent. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.